From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Governor Gretchen Whitmer says free college, but what does the plan really pay?
What sorts of costs are you actually covering? So tuition and fees are obviously a big expense, but there are a lot of other expenses that go along with going to school.
Our political commentators discuss the governor's State of the State address.
The one thing that did get a standing ovation from both sides of the aisle was addressing auto insurance rates.
We talked to a Republican about the legislature, in a rare move, rejecting a governor's executive order.
Those new laws and panels deserved a chance to try to address a lot of the problems that the department's been having.
And a member of a congressional task force on PFAS contamination says the EPA needs to move faster.
It could be 2, 3, 4 years before we would see any protection from PFAS in drinking water. That's completely unacceptable. They're dragging their feet.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up on today's show, our Friday political commentators grade Governor Whitmer's first State of the State address. But first, this week, the Michigan legislature disapproved executive orders by Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Whitmer wanted to reorganize the Department of Environmental Quality and eliminate some oversight panels. Joining me is a senator who led the effort to reject those executive orders, Senator Ed McBroom. Welcome to Stateside.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
This is the first time in more than 40 years that the legislature has rejected a governor's executive order. Why did you think it was necessary this time?
Well, I'll say that personally, I think that the legislature has really dropped the ball sometimes in the past on rejecting executive orders. Particularly, they should have done it a lot to Governor Engler, in my opinion, who eliminated a lot of citizen commissions and boards that I think serve a great opportunity for the public to provide oversight and input into the rulemaking and the permitting process. In this particular situation, these panels were just created. Summer of last year, June was when the laws were passed. They had just begun having their first meetings for organizing here in December and January. And I thought many of us agreed, and I thought, too, that those new laws and panels deserved a chance to try to address a lot of the problems that the department's been having, which many of the environmental community that came into my committee the past 2 weeks recognized had existed for well over 30 years. And the executive order really simply puts us back to that previous status quo. So it's difficult for me to understand why are we fighting to return things to the way they were.
Yeah, some of the environmental groups have been critical of these oversight panels as established by Governor Snyder because they say business and industry fill half the seats. What do you say to that concern?
Well, you know, I've heard that allegation and, you know, it's always been a little bit of a frustration for me that the groups from some of the environmental perspective or other groups will always try to have all of the seats to themselves. So you have business issues and the people say, well, it should only be business people on here. And then you have environmental issues and the environmental groups will say, well, it should only be people from our frame of reference who are on these panels. I think having the more balanced approach is important. And so some of these panels, there's one farmer, there's a scientist, there's a doctor, there's people from industry, there's people from the environmental groups. I think that's a more balanced approach because truly the environmental issues are apply to all of us. And so whether you're trying to get a permit for your home, your septic, putting up a little shed to store your snowmobile in, or building a big factory, all of us are impacted by this. And so it's really important that we have folks from many walks of life. And if you look at the folks who are appointed, the scientific background, knowledge, and experience that were put on these panels is really exceptional.
Not to use the cliche because it's been said a lot of times, but it was asked, doesn't this leave the fox in charge of the hen house?
Well, I would disagree, as I said, because the panels have that balance on there. I mean, it's not all farmers writing all the rules for farmers. It's not all industry writing rules for industry. There is this balance on there. And the panels that the governor created in the executive order were all just bureaucrats. They were all just her appointees. And so, I mean, all of them could be pro or anti any perspective. So I thought that these panels for oversight were a much more balanced approach and really could make a difference. And now we're really, the executive order just created these panels that she had with her people on there, not her appointees. I don't have a problem with that. But just her directors, just bureaucrats, And that's not really providing the access to justice that was testified in committee that we needed. We have people being denied permits, and then there's no real recourse for a regular person. A big company, they can go to court. They have money. They can fight for their permit. But you and me, if we do something that some agent of the state says, don't do that, denies us a permit, and we want to litigate that, we're out of luck, most of us, because most of us don't have $100,000 around to fight for a $50 permit.
It was reported that Senate Majority Leader Shirky suggested Governor Whitmer submit a different reorganization plan for the DEQ, which maintains these oversight panels. How does that work for you?
I think there were a lot of things in the executive order that weren't a problem for me. She wants to change the name. She wants to move the office of the Great Lakes. She wants to move the energy office. I mean, we can work with all of those things, but to return back to the status quo on how permits and regulations are issued and how people are handled and access for the general public to that process, the transparency that the panels brought, I don't want to end those things. But regardless of all that, I certainly want to be a part of the conversation. If the governor doesn't like things about the panels, he wants changes to the law, then let's work together on that. Let's amend the law through the legislative process. And work together on these things. I think it was just a bit of a misfire for all of us to kind of not talk enough before this executive order came out, and that we can get a lot more cooperation and a lot more goodwill done if we all kind of work together.
Senator Ed McBroom is a Republican from Vulcan in the Upper Peninsula. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yesterday, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency indicated it would start the process of creating new drinking water limits for PFAS chemicals. PFAS stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. The chemicals come from a number of sources, including fire foam used at airports, waterproof clothing, and in chrome plating processes. PFAS chemicals have been linked to a number of health issues. Joining us now is U.S. Representative Dan Kildee, who recently launched a congressional task force on PFAS contamination. Welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So environmental groups say the U.S. EPA in this announcement yesterday is actually dragging its feet on this issue of a drinking water standard. What's your take?
Well, I was really disappointed. We, you know, have been awaiting some action from EPA on this issue for a long time. There are serious contamination problems around the country. I have at least three in my own district. The science is making it very clear that PFAS is a dangerous family of chemicals that has significant health impacts on people. And the EPA, which was designed to protect public health, is announcing a plan to think about making a plan at some point in the future.
Right. It's a take the first steps towards setting a drinking water limit by the end of this year. Is that the right pace for you?
Well, I mean, and I don't even know what that means. The first steps to develop a standard. Think about this. We've been waiting now for about 4 years for an update to the lead and copper rule. This administration has waited 2 years and hasn't even moved forward on updating the lead and copper rule. So if we take them at their word and look at their track record, and they don't even start thinking about what a drinking water standard might look like until the end of this year, it could be 2, 3, 4 years before we would see any protection from PFAS in drinking water. That's completely unacceptable. They're dragging their feet, and they clearly don't want to address this issue.
Congressman, help me understand this, because the U.S. EPA health advisory for PFAS in drinking water is 70 parts per trillion. The CDC, ATSDR, the agencies working together, says it should be something like 18 parts per trillion. My question is, when we're finding water at thousands of parts per trillion, why doesn't the EPA peg it at 70 parts per trillion for now and quibble about a lower level if necessary for a permanent standard later, or, you know, take first steps by the end of the year?
Well, that seems very reasonable, and it would be supported by science. But that assumes that the agency that we're talking about takes seriously the commitment that was made when the agency was founded. It is the Environmental Protection Agency, but they clearly have not been functioning in a way to protect the environment, to protect people from dangerous chemicals. And it's really a reflection of this administration's whole orientation. They proudly display every moment when they erase important environmental protections. They herald every opportunity they have to reduce the kind of constraints that are on corporations or other polluters, because that's what they believe in. I have to believe this. It's a terrible conclusion to come to, but they fundamentally do not believe in the mission of the organization that they've been charged to lead. That's a frightening thought, and there are consequences to that.
Only a few states, like Michigan, are actively looking for PFAS contamination. Are members of Congress generally aware and ready to do something to deal with this PFAS contamination? I mean, what can Congress do? And is everybody aware of the problem?
Well, they're only becoming aware typically when they have a PFAS contamination that's discovered in their districts. This substance, this family of substances, are ubiquitous. They're virtually everywhere in the environment. There are at least 400 potential sites from the U.S. military alone across the country, but people don't become aware of them until a contamination is located. That's one of the reasons that Congressman Jack Bergman, my Republican colleague from Northern Michigan, he and I have legislation that we've introduced that would require the U.S. Geological Survey to go and locate all those sites, not just to wait for some contamination to be accidentally discovered, but actually actively get out there and find them. I think only then, only when we get a full handle on the size and scope of this problem, will we see many more members of Congress join this cause. Now, we do have a bipartisan task force that we launched just a few weeks ago. Democrats and Republicans, you know, dozens of members now that are coming together to address this. But we're at the very front end of this, and my hope is that we can move much more quickly. If EPA won't act, Congress clearly will have to step in and require the EPA to do the job that they were chartered to do.
Congressman Dan Kildee, a Democrat from Flint, is part of a bipartisan group in Congress addressing PFAS chemical contamination. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
To find out more about PFAS chemicals, what they are, how they might be harmful to your health, go to michiganradio.org and search for PFAS Explained. That's PFAS Explained. Coming up, Governor Whitmer called for a more educated workforce in her State of the State address this week. No doubt that means enrolling more first-generation college students. After the break, we'll get some advice on how to navigate the college world from students who are the first in their family to attend.
You know, college is your time to figure out what you love and what you're passionate about, so take as many general classes as you want to figure out what you want to do, because you want to go into a job that you're going to love, you know, so don't be afraid to take some extra time if you need to.
That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Universities are paying more attention to its first-generation students. Those are students who are the first in their family to go to college and earn a degree. While a lot has been written and policy has been adjusted, really, there's not a lot of information about how first-generation students fare at a four-year college. So we thought we'd talk to a couple of them. Samantha Inkster is a senior at Central Michigan University. Elena Burke is a freshman at the University of Michigan. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Sam, you've been at school for a while. What was it like, you know, the first time stepping on campus? Mm-hmm. And give me a little idea how you were feeling when you were a freshman.
Yeah, so obviously really, really nervous. You know, I didn't really have any expectations or anything. I didn't know what to expect. Choosing my school was interesting. I only looked at colleges in Michigan. I never really thought about going outside of Michigan at all. I competed for the honors program and the honors scholarship available at Central Michigan, and I received it. So that was basically my deciding factor of where I was going to go. And going there my freshman year, I was undecided. I did not know what I wanted to do at all. My sophomore year, luckily, I had met just some friends, and honestly, one of them was another first-generation student, too, and he kind of helped me decide and what I wanted to do, which was biology, and I ended up just talking to people, and through that, I found out what my passion was and how to get to where I wanted to go.
It was a lot of people do that in their third year, I think. Elena, without someone who had experience with a university, how did you navigate the bureaucracy, the culture of a university? What surprised you?
I think a lot of things surprised me. I know coming in, I was worried about being able to handle the workload, but I'm part of a scholarship program called the Kessler Scholarship, and it's a group of 36 other first-generation students who are freshmen, And that's been a great support group. I can talk to the other students and get advice on issues I'm having, or even advisors within the program help me a lot with discussing possible majors and how to prepare for work I'm doing in my classes.
So what's been the most nerve-wracking thing for you guys?
I think for me, it was definitely the workload and then the social aspects, being able to find a good group of friends on campus who could keep me on track, who had the same goals as me, help me with anything I can need in my classes, even if it's as simple as, you know, reading over a paper before I turn it in.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And a lot of my friends, I feel like when we went into college, knew what they wanted to do and, you know, how to get there, just because they had, you know, parents or whatever that had gone and kind of could tell them what to expect as in regards to choosing the career path that you wanted to go on. And me being completely undecided, that was really, really nerve-wracking for me going in, because I felt like I was supposed to know. But after I got there, I realized that a lot of people don't know when they get there, and a lot of people actually change their mind halfway through too, which is fine. So
we're going to ask you guys for some advice. What should other students keep in mind once they're aware that you're a first-generation student? Could they be more helpful to you? Could they maybe recognize that, you know, this might be every day for you because you had an older brother and an older sister who went to school, but this is all brand new for you? I guess it's, what would you advise people who just aren't aware that this is so fresh for you?
I think for me, a big thing is just being okay that I am a first-generation student. I don't know everything that's going to happen. So just being okay with that and recognizing that there will be points in time where they will need help, and not being afraid to ask for help, because that little bit of help could get you from a C to an A or allow you to meet new people.
Yeah, I'd say definitely don't be afraid to ask questions. Or ask anybody questions, because you will find a lot of people on the same page as you, honestly. And then I've noticed at my university, just like, everybody's just willing to help you get no matter what you want. There's somebody there who will have an answer to what you're asking, and you just need to take advantage of all the resources that are available.
Are there things the universities should be doing to make life a little easier for someone who's just not familiar with the whole campus culture?
I definitely think that there needs to be a bigger recognition of first-generation college students. I feel like that should be a group where people can go and get advice and meet people that are similar to them. And we don't have that currently, but it definitely should be something.
I was fortunate enough to be accepted into my Kessler Scholarship Program, where I am around other first-gen students, but other campuses that don't have that, or even just Michigan itself, could probably have more support groups for first-generation students who aren't part of like a scholarship group or any other types of organizations. Because just having that environment where you know you're not alone and it's like a larger group, because I didn't expect to see so many first-gen students on campus. Knowing that there were a lot made me feel a little better, because I knew I wasn't just by myself. I wasn't the only one going through these struggles.
I'm wondering how your families have been able to help, because, you know, as a parent, I know you've got to deal with FAFSA and those kinds of things. And if you're a parent who's not familiar with all the paperwork that goes into getting your kid into school, it's a lot and it's pretty daunting. How have your parents been able to help you out?
They have helped me every step of the way, because I think they were just excited as I was kind of to go through the whole process as well. You know, we learn together, and they've been extremely supportive. They're my biggest support system. So I think just them being excited about me doing something that they didn't do was really a pushing factor for them to be there every step of the way.
I actually just called my parents the other day to fill out my FAFSA. So I think from a young age, my parents really started getting in my head the idea of going to college, and them being really supportive about it and kind of strict about I really need to go to college. Mm-hmm. Just that helped a lot with just me internalizing the idea, like, I have to go to college to get a better education, have a better life, get really good jobs. And then also having your parents go through different processes with you. I included my parents in the process of applying to college, going through FAFSA, just educating them as well as learning new things myself was really good. And counselors in high school helped me a lot.
Well, you're both very lucky to have parents who were that supportive, because not everybody gets that break.
No, so
you should give your mom and dad a kiss next time you go home. So what do you want your profession to be?
I'm going to grad school for marine biology.
From Central? That's interesting.
I know,
you're a little distant from water.
Yeah, I know.
I'm currently undecided, but I'm thinking about women's studies and public health.
Sam, what advice as a senior would you give to Elena, who's just starting out at school?
Like I mentioned before, that it's totally okay to be undecided. Like, don't feel like you have to rush. And, you know, people have in their mind that you have to get your bachelor's degree in 4 years. And, like, I mean, that's the goal, I guess, but it's okay if you don't. You know, this college is your time to figure out what you love and what you're passionate about. So take as many general classes as you want to figure out what you want to do, because you want to go into a job that you're going to love, you know. So don't be afraid to take some extra time if you need to.
I wish you the best of luck. I know it can be tough as a first gen myself, but I know you guys are going to do well. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Coming in.
Thank you for having me.
That is Elena Burke. She's a freshman at the University of Michigan, and Sam Angster, a senior at Central Michigan University. In her first State of the State address, Governor Gretchen Whitmer said that this spring she's launching a program that will pay for college. Here's what that means for community college students.
The My Opportunity Scholarship will guarantee 2 years of debt-free community college for all graduating high school students who qualify.
And here's the deal for university-bound students.
The My Opportunity Scholarship will provide 2 years of tuition assistance at a four-year not-for-profit college or university for students who graduate from a Michigan high school with at least a B average.
Several states around the nation are offering some kind of free college, but how they do it varies. Joining me now is someone who's studied this growing trend of free college. Jen Mashori is a senior fellow at the think tank The Century Foundation. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So last year, you published a report on some states that offered one kind of free college or another to see if they maintain that program during the Great Recession. Why that time period?
Well, you know, I was interested in looking at a time period where states were really struggling with their budgets and were often decreasing the amount of state revenue they were sending to higher education institutions and to state financial aid programs. So I wanted to look and see when states provided their financial aid through a guarantee, through a promise to their students, were they more likely to keep that promise during the recession?
What'd you find?
It turned out that a lot of states, or that actually all six states that I looked at, that had a program providing state financial aid as a promise, as a guarantee to cover tuition, actually did retain that promise over what was a very tough budgetary time for states.
What about the other end of student aid, like grants, Pell Grants? Well, Pell Grants are federal, but state grants and the universities or colleges themselves and their funding?
Sure. In a lot of cases during the recession, states were cutting back. In fact, almost all states cut back on the number of dollars they were sending per student to their colleges. And as a result, we saw tuition increase significantly over time. And in the state of Michigan, you know, we saw a similar story where tuition at community colleges increased by about a third over the last decade, and also increased by about a third at four-year institutions as well, and that's accounting for inflation.
So with this other state support falling, how did that end up balancing out for students and for the institutions and for the state budget?
Sure. I mean, as states were sending fewer dollars to their institutions per student, it meant that students and families have been picking up a larger percentage of the cost, and we're seeing and have seen tuition go up. Now, over the last couple of years, you're starting to see some states come back and start to reinvest per student. But in a large number of cases, states are not actually providing the same level of support that they did before the recession. And I think that, you know, that's really starting to drive a conversation around, serious conversation around the cost of college. And you're seeing a lot of states talk about these free college programs.
If a state makes a promise of free college, is there a risk that state finances could make it unsustainable if we hit another big recession?
Well, you know, I think that, of course, budgets are about priorities and values. So I think there's a big question about, you know, states really planning for the ability to have the revenue to pay for things that are important investments like higher education. I think when you're looking at a free college or a free community college program, what you are seeing, though, is a lot of states making decisions about how to offer that program in a way that, you know, effectively contains the cost. So, for example, you're seeing some states that are saying, you know, we're going to give free college to students that are enrolled only full-time and not part-time, or we're going to provide free community college only to students who meet a certain GPA. And so you're seeing a lot of states, you know, not really at a point where they're providing that commitment to students across the board.
You noted that in your report that states vary in eligibility requirements, such as income caps, enrollment intensity, high school curriculum requirements. It sounds like from your study, there's no set pattern for states' free college programs. So what seems to work?
You know, I think that's right. There is really no clear pattern that states are sort of crafting their own programs. I mean, another really common decision is states deciding only to cover students when they leave high school and not to cover adults who might be going back and looking for skills. And we're seeing that the proposal in Michigan is actually saying, no, we want to cover adults who want to go back to school and gain new skills, which is great because you're reaching a larger population. And another question is, what sorts of costs are you actually covering? So tuition and fees are obviously a big expense, but there are a lot of other expenses that go along with going to school, so a lot of non-tuition costs. So you might have a student coming from a family where they're receiving some support. So, for example, some support from a Pell Grant from the federal government. But really the large costs are coming with, even if they're working, you know, multiple hours a week, being able to pay their rent and buy food when they're also trying to attend school. Those are all parts of a decision that the state is going to have to make in terms of what costs they're covering, who's actually going to be eligible. And really, we have not seen a consistent decision across states in terms of what they are covering and who they're covering.
You compared universal free college programs and means-tested free college programs. First, could you tell us what you mean by universal and means-tested?
Sure. And again, I think that states define universal differently, but certainly there are some states where a state that was trying to limit costs, some states decided they're not going to cover part-time students, or they're not going to cover older students. And in some states, they said, actually, we're going to cover all of those students, but we're just going to have to put a cap by income and say we're going to cover the tuition for students earning up to, for example, in Indiana, they have a program where they cover up to $46,000 a year, approximately. So all students from families earning up to that amount will receive free tuition. Another way that states might look at designing their program would be to say, we're only going to cover certain costs, tuition fees, books, transportation for students if they have financial need. So if their families can't already afford to pay for school and they would otherwise have to, for example, take on student debt to pay for this, then we're going to go ahead and cover that. And those are more of the debt-free community college or debt-free college programs. And I did see that the governor in her proposal has included some mention of debt-free, and I think it was actually in her campaign proposal. So it'll be interesting to see how that might play out as her team is really pulling together the details of the proposal.
So we've only got a minute or so here. What state is doing free college the right way?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's been such a movement over the last few years among states to expand these kinds of programs, it's actually really early. So we have a couple of examples from programs that have been around for a while, and we're seeing, you know, states where, for example, the Indiana program that's been around for a long time, you know, has really shown to impact the number of students who are able to enroll and afford college. in Tennessee, we're still waiting for some of that really rigorous research to come out about some of the results, but we do know that college going is up in the state. After Tennessee passed their program, a number of states really stepped up and started passing programs. And we just don't have data on what the results have been over the last couple of years, and hopefully we will for the next couple.
When you consider things like political buy-in and so forth, if you had a couple of minutes to advise Governor Whitmer, what would you tell her?
Well, you know, I think it's really important for both the success of the program in terms of reaching students, reaching the public, to really have a clear program. We actually know this from the data that when financial aid programs, free college programs are really clear in their message and what they're providing to students, more students know about it. More students take up the program and they engage in the program. And I think that's true across the board when folks really have a clear sense of what's available for them. So that's one piece. And, you know, second, I'd say really looking into ensuring that things like non-tuition costs, like transportation and books and all of the expenses we know that go into being able to afford college are really on the table and part of the discussion as they're designing the program.
Jen Mashori is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, we introduce you to a Michigan artisan who brings a lot of bang for the buck. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For a couple of years now, we've been visiting with the people who make the things we use. We call the series Artisans of Michigan. Today's visit takes us to Adrian in Lenawee County, we're in the shop of Johnson's Sporting Goods to talk with Stephen Duran. He makes custom firearms, mostly early American style from the Civil War to World War I.
Is this walnut?
Yes, this is American walnut.
These are not exact reproductions, but they're in the style of those single-shot and bolt-action rifles. He started out as a metalsmith, making the barrels and the mechanisms for the guns. Then he started making the wood stocks, too, like this one on his bench. He's certified by the American Custom Gunmakers Guild.
So now it says I'm a stock maker and metalsmith.
How rare is that?
There are a few that are doing both.
When you say a few in the nation?
Well, the guild itself currently stands at 95 members. There are other gun makers in the country that are certainly of guild quality. They just haven't applied and they're not part of the guild. The people that can do this, you know, guild quality work, there's a couple hundred in the country, and that's about it.
Of course, the metalsmithing is complex, but there's a lot more that goes into making a stock than you might imagine. It's about strength, and it's about the beauty of the wood, and that wood is rare.
Well, I deal with people who are out buying trees, and also you don't cut down a tree to make stocks, you dig it up, because a lot of the figure is in the root burl. So, you know, it's a separate industry. The wood is much more expensive that way, you know, much more expensive than a lumber, you know, piece of lumber. This piece of wood here, it's American black walnut, which is less expensive than English. This piece of wood was about $300. I consider that not very expensive.
Does it make that much of a difference?
In terms of function on the stock, no. It really doesn't matter.
So this is all about aesthetics.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Typically, the guns I'm building sell for $6,000 to $10,000. An extra few hundred dollars on the wood, money well spent.
His work is featured in magazines. The people who buy his custom-made rifles are either high-end gun enthusiasts or they're big game hunters. He says he exhibits and sells at places like the Dallas Safari Club Convention and Sporting Expo, which draws thousands of hunters who are not always familiar with custom-made rifles.
I draw them in, and I say, you have to pick it up. That's a feature you can't describe. It feels, it's lighter, it's racier, that's part of what you're getting in spending $9,000 to get a rifle. It has a feel. It feels alive, and it naturally goes to the point of aim, and it's a nice feel. You see, I put it in their hands, and you see their eyes light up.
Actually, now that you've said that, if you don't mind, I'd like to...
Yes, please.
Well, here, Trey, you hold the microphone.
All right.
I'll hold that rifle. Well, it is... It just seems like the grip is not usual. I mean, you don't find this on a rifle.
It's a little different. It's a more open curve, and then it's smaller in diameter.
And I've never looked through a sight that nicely. Yeah. That's the nicest sight I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's a loophole. That's a good American-made scope.
The inspiration for this custom rifle is a World War II-era Czechoslovakian mass-produced bolt-action rifle called the VZ-24. The metal of the custom-made gun is much more sophisticated than the original and nothing like what you'd find at a discount sporting goods store. But that stock, that wood stock, is the first thing you notice. It's not just pretty wood. There's a lot of geometry that goes into designing the stock to make it balance and function in a way the original rifle does not.
There's a lot there.
They didn't put that kind of thought into that Czechoslovakian.
No, they did not. And as you look at, you know, a factory gun or a beginning stock maker's gun, and then look at a higher-end stock, one thing you'll notice on the higher-end stock is there's less wood. It becomes thinner, more graceful, more flowing.
When I picked it up, that's one of the first things I noticed. It was get your hand around like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I kept this, and I wanted this to be a fairly light gun, and it's reasonably light. You know, say when I go to the show and I hand it to people, that's something that's light. It's lighter than they expected. That's what we're after.
Duren went to gunsmithing school right out of high school, but there wasn't a lot of work, so he ended up working at a machine shop for several years. About 20 years ago, he got back into gunsmithing. At first, it was repairing or customizing rifles, and he eventually got to the point he was making custom rifles almost exclusively, and he's a happy guy about that.
Yeah, I get up in the morning and think about what gun I'm working on, and you know, I come home, eat dinner, and go down in the basement and work on another one.
So what are you working on at home right now?
A bolt-action rifle for myself. I have an issue when I build a rifle for myself. Since I like money, I'll take it to the show and I will put a price tag on it, and then somebody comes along and buys it. So I have to make another one. This one that I'm building now, I think I'll actually put a sign on it that says not for sale. I'll just show it off.
Stephen Duren, metalsmith, stockmaker for custom-built rifles, our latest artisan of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Since the beginning of this year, at least a dozen Michigan State Police vehicles have been struck by careless drivers. That's what the state police told the Free Press earlier this week. On Wednesday, a new state law took effect that's aimed at trying to make the roads safer for our emergency responders and those who come to the aid of motorists. With me now is Lieutenant Michael Shaw with the Michigan State Police. So this new law is an expansion of the so-called move over law that we already have on the books. What are the changes we need to know about?
So basically, it was a tweak of the 2001 law. So there's only two major changes to it. The first one is it actually identifies emergency vehicles and adds a few to that category, tow trucks being one, construction vehicles, garbage trucks, and utility trucks. And the second part of it is it actually adds a speed limit to the slow down portion of the move over law. So now when traffic approaches any type of emergency vehicle with its lights activated, you're required to slow down to 10 miles less than the posted speed limit. For an example, if the speed limit on the freeway is 70 miles an hour, when you approach that emergency vehicle, all lanes of traffic have to slow down to 60 miles an hour.
Could you give us an idea of how serious of an issue this is for state troopers? Do you have examples?
Quite a bit. So I covered the Detroit area, so I have the second district here for the state police. And right now we're in a phase of we've survived 2 days where somebody hasn't hit one of our patrol cars. So I can't remember a time and a place that I've been that we've had this many patrol cars hit. We went probably 7 days in a row where somebody was striking one of our patrol cars. Some of it is not moving over, and other parts of it is just the sheer amount of distracted driving that's going on in our state.
Can't blame the weather then.
Nope, you can never blame the weather. I always tell people if you're involved in some type of crash during the weather and you really want to know its fault, take a look in the rearview mirror, and that's your party that's at fault.
I want to ask you, is it worse in Michigan than it is other states?
No, this is a national issue. Almost every state, I believe every state, has some type of move over law. But all you have to do is go on any type of social media, and usually you'll see at least once or twice a day an example of somebody that's either striking one of our troopers out on the roadways or another state's trooper or one of our cars.
What's the punishment for violating the new conditions, the new law?
The new one is a $400 fine. It's a civil infraction for the first offense.
That is Lieutenant Shaw with the State Police. Thanks very much for telling us about how this new law works.
You're very welcome.
Speaking of stuff coming out of Lansing, it's Friday. Let's check with our political commentators. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic state legislator. Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican legislative leader. The legislature rejected an executive order issued by Governor Gretchen Whitmer. This is the first time the legislature has done that since 1977. Whitmer wanted to rearrange how the Department of Environmental Quality works. She wanted it to turn it into the Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy. In the process, she would eliminate some oversight boards. The last legislature and Governor Snyder approved in the lame duck session. Vicki, it's rare an executive order is rejected. What do you think of this move?
I don't think it bodes well for total cooperation between the branches of government. I understand why the Senate and the House majorities rejected the order, because they want to keep these, what the Democrats call polluter panels in place. And that's industry-based, heavily industry-based panels that would oversee the DEQ or whatever the department will be called. Wanted to oversee their permitting rules. And I agree with the governor. We don't need those panels. They slow down permitting processes when there is a need to move quickly. And we have some severe problems with groundwater and our environment that need to be dealt with, and not in a cooperative way necessarily with industry, but despite the industry polluters.
Ken, this legislative rejection of the executive order, is this just a matter of checks and balances, or is there something more here?
Well, I know this has been portrayed as some big power struggle, but I have a different take on this. I think it's healthy in the sense that it's part of the normal sorting out process when you have split government, and they have to figure out what their working relationship is going to be and what the parameters are. And I really think the silver lining in all of this is that it's going to be good for the governor, good for the Republican leadership in the legislature, and ultimately good for the citizens of Michigan, because I frankly think it's going to help create a productive relationship rather than hinder it. It's just, you know, they're feeling each other out. They're trying to figure out what they can sort of get away with and what you can't. And I really think this is going to be healthy ultimately.
I want to talk about this whole idea of bipartisan cooperation. This week, during the State of the State address that was on Tuesday, the Democratic governor's references to bipartisanship and friendly comments to legislative leaders and all that cooperative spirit. I'm wondering if that's just wishful thinking or a real overture to the Republican-led legislature. Vicki?
I think it's a real overture. It's also wishful thinking, but I think that there's going to be major opportunities for cooperation. On the same day the governor issued her State of the State address, the Republican leadership in the House and the Senate gave her a list of things that were their top priorities. And amazingly, they're similar items, including fixing the roads, fixing education, and making sure that we can clean our drinking water environment. And, of course, the one thing that did get a standing ovation from both sides of the aisle was addressing auto insurance rates. So there's opportunity to cooperate here. They want to do the same things. They want to be on the same page. And it's just a question now of how they're going to sit down to make sure that they can get these things done.
Ken, Governor Whitmer made some personal references to leaders in the House and Senate. Sounded like she was trying to be friendly. What'd you make of that?
You know, the State of the State speech, I thought, was a forceful speech. But at the end, that kind of very deft touch of talking about their humanity and shared humanity and making some personal references to the four legislative leaders, it was what I thought it did is it prevented the speech from becoming confrontational. And like I said, it allowed her to be forceful, articulating her agenda, but at the same time, not kind of crossing the border into being confrontational. I thought it was, I thought you did a very good job, and that thing at the end there, I think, really helped.
Let's talk about
I do, too. I think that it really showed the humanity of everybody that's in the legislature trying to work on problems that affect the people of Michigan. And I thought it was, the whole tone of her speech was non-confrontational. It was about setting out an agenda where everybody could work together, and talking about her open door policy and meeting with the department heads and the staff of government agencies. I thought it was a great tone-setting speech for that quality.
Well, it might have tone, but not a lot of specifics, especially when it came to some of the leading things like fixing the roads and her idea of debt-free college. Did you hear enough to wait for the budget address that will come later, or did you want to hear more?
I always want to hear more, but I'm a policy wonk, so of course I want to hear more. But this was an hour-long speech. I mean, if she could have gone on for 4 hours and talked more deeply about all of those things, but she really needs to sit down in quadrant meetings with the leadership and the minority leadership to talk about what can get done and how they can get it done and come up with some bills to accomplish their goals.
I still find that term quadrant meetings funny. I'd rather call them the four tops. But anyway.
Leadership meetings. You could call them leadership meetings.
Ken, what'd you think of that? Enough substance for you, or are you happy with what you heard, or did you want to hear more?
Well, the one criticism of the speech is that, you know, nobody knows how this all fits together. You know, fixing the roads, fixing the schools, and sort of the, you know, where's all this money coming from? But with that being said, you know, you probably don't do that in the State of the State speech. You establish your agenda. The budget message comes out here in a couple of weeks. But she's got to, clearly, and she knows this, she's got to get specific about how this all fits together.
Does avoiding the specifics right now kind of help in the negotiation between her office and the legislature?
I think it does. It sets out goals. And it lets the legislature know what her goals are. And then we have to figure out how we're going to meet those goals. I doubt when we talk about fixing the roads that Ken's 47 cent per gallon gas tax is going to come up. But now, we should explain that.
What, Ken, what's your 47 cent gas tax about?
Well, the you know, a group of former leaders, including myself, two Democrats, two Republicans, have proposed that you phase in a gas tax increase over 9 years. At the end, it's 47 cent increase. But that's what it would take to meet the need as outlined by the Governor Snyder's 21st Century Infrastructure Commission.
So do you, Ken, think this strategy of saying, here's some of the things I want to do without the specifics attached to them, puts her in a good negotiating place?
Well, I think, you know, the situation, if you will, is developing, as Vicky's kind of indicated. You know, she's outlined her agenda in broad terms. The Republican leadership has outlined their agenda in similarly broad terms. And obviously, you now have to get very specific about how you're going to solve these problems. But as Vicky pointed out, it's pretty encouraging that the Republican leadership in the legislature has said, yeah, we're going to have to find some revenue to fix the roads. But we're getting to the point where, you know, the rubber meets the road, so to speak, here, and you're going to have to get concrete and specific about how you're going to solve all these problems.
Final question. I'd like you guys to give it a letter grade. What kind of grade would you give Governor Whitmer's first State of the State, Vicki?
Oh, I hate letter grades, Lester. I thought she got an A for bipartisanship
and a B for lack of specifics.
Ken, how about you?
No, I'd give her a high grade. You know, it was a good State of the State speech, a good first State of the State speech, so I think she gets a high grade.
That is Ken Sikkema. He's Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican Majority Leader in the Senate. Vicki Marinette is the former mayor of Farmington Hills and served in the state legislature as a Democrat. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Bob Scott. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Joy Horan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.